We'll bring the meeting of the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee to order. This morning we're going to hear House File 72, Representative Beard's bill that deals with carbon dioxide emissions. Our intention is to hear from both sides. If there's any citizens that are interested in testifying, if you haven't let us know, if you could let us know through one of the pages after they get done scurrying around. Ben, if you can raise your hand. I don't see Luke here yet today, but if you can let Ben know, and he'll help you get signed up to testify. If you are testifying and you have handouts, would you please be aware that we're certainly capable to read the handouts, and if you want to hit the highlights in the handouts, that'll help us a great deal, and it'll actually get your point across much better. Representative Beard, if you would go to the testifying table and when you get your stuff in order, that would be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. I'd like to move House File 72, move its adoption, and refer it, I believe, to Commerce. Is that where you'd like it to go, Mr. Chairman?
I believe, Representative Beard, that is correct. The motion is to pass the bill and refer it to Commerce. Go ahead.
Well, members, it's good to be in front of the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee this morning. For my bill is all about these issues, particularly about natural resources, specifically what economists and others call the ultimate resource. No, I'm not talking about oil or wind or water, as important as these are. I'm speaking specifically about the well-being of the ultimate resource on this planet, and that would be human beings, people, and how we live, and how this bill will liberate and empower them with the robust and reliable supplies, what we call the master resource. That would be affordable and abundant electrical energy so that we can live our lives healthy, prosperous, and free. House File 72 proposes to repeal a section of law that passed this body in 2007, Senate File 145, also known as the Next Generation Act. This bill would lift what I believe to be an ill-advised moratorium that prevents Minnesota utilities from importing electrical energy from outside of this state if that power was generated by coal. Even worse, it prohibits any Minnesota company from building a new baseload facility in this state if it's fueled by coal, no matter how clean the technology be for using that source. Yes, you heard it correctly. There will be no industrial tax base expanding in this state, no new high-paying jobs if they're connected to a new power plant that is fueled by America's most abundant resource, fuel. This would go to exactly the ultimate resource, which would be our human beings, the citizens we represent. Now, members, the Next Generation Act only addresses what I call intermittent energy. Supplemental energy, some of you call it renewable energy, or clean energy. It also talks some about efficiencies, but members, it does nothing to address our baseload energy needs. The Next Generation Act does not do enough to encourage clean energy, in my opinion. In fact, I would submit that it discourages clean energy technology from being applied to our most abundant domestic resource, coal. Unlike what Minnesota Public Radio might have mentioned about my position on energy, we need to use all energy sources. They all need to be on the table. You notice a week ago we talked about nuclear, the cleanest fuel source we have. Today we're talking about coal, our most abundant and reliable domestic resource, and our ability to apply technology to use that as cleanly and safely as we possibly can to defend our most ultimate resource, people. And that means jobs, and that means prosperity. The Next Generation Act only depends on fuels that aren't ready for prime time. It's focused entirely on fuel or energy sources that we've been working with for over 100 years, mostly windmills, solar panels, and the like. We've been burning biomass since man invented fire. We're still messing around with biomass. Now, all these things are good, Technology can make incremental advances, but folks, they're not ready for prime time now. They weren't in the 1970s when I was a kid at the first Earth Day, and they won't be ready for prime time as baseload power before our kids need them in the next round of baseload generation. We need balance in our system. At the moment, the Next Gen Act has taken us way out of balance, members. We need a balanced approach to reliable and affordable energy that's as clean as possible from all sources. Mr. Chairman, members, and audience, if alternative energies are to have a fighting chance of developing without being on the government dole forever and without wrecking our economy with mandates and subsidies, we need a robust, reliable, and affordable system of baseload power that can make that possible and afford it to work. In our grid right now, we're running with almost no margins. Did anyone remember that we're in the middle of a recession and we're running at the edge of our margins? When the economy picks up, and it will, we will be buying off the grid, we'll be running right against the wall, and that's an expensive proposition. I should mention, too, that contrary to what a certain public radio station was saying, this bill leaves the traditional process and regulations in place for utilities that are regulated by the government. The integrated resource plans continue to exist and have to be updated regularly. The power companies are continue to be held to reliability and quality standards for their power. If they prove a need, there is a certificate of need process, the siting process, and the environmental approvals would all be required as before. That does not change. Members, this just allows our utilities, our state, to actually consider building the wealth and prosperity of this state within the borders of this state, and that is the essence of House File 72. Mr. Chairman, I'm ready to stand for questions or testifiers.
Representative Beard, I think first we'll bring down the advocates for the presentation. I have on the list Mike Jones, Eric Olson, Reed Seifert, I think is how she pronounces it, sorry, and Harry Melander from the Building and Trades Council. I think I saw Harry come in. If you guys could all come down to testify together, the pages will help get chairs together, and remember to identify yourself, and if we could have you come down now. And Representative Beard, are you fine with that, if we go like that? All right, thank you. Oh, you know what, Representative Beard? I messed up, folks. Sorry. Is Kate O'Connell here? Kate, we were going to hear from the Office of Energy Security. I apologize, folks. You can take a deep breath. I messed up. Kate's with the Office of Energy Security. For a couple minutes, you were going to lay out the administration, your agency's, some thoughts on this bill and on the energy situation. If you could go ahead, Ms. O'Connell.
Thank you. My name is Kate O'Connell. I'm the Acting Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security. I'll try to warm up the seat here so it'll be ready to go when the next folks come. I appreciate being able to talk to you today because I want to talk about the overall energy policy in Minnesota and how 216H fits within that policy. For the most part, Minnesota energy policy for electric utilities is embedded in Chapter 216B, and in that policy, there's a balance of all kinds of economic and policy issues. For example, utilities must provide reliable service. They must provide service at reasonable rates. They must maintain a basic level of conservation, and they must consider renewable resources unless it would not be in the public interest to do so. And that key phrase, unless it would not be in the public interest to do so, shows the balance that is in Minnesota law between making sure that we have reliable, affordable energy and that we're able to do what we can to promote social goals. And it sounds like those two things might be at odds with each other, and sometimes they are. But what we've been finding lately, and we've actually been surprised, I have a group of economists who work in my office, we've been surprised that those two things have gone together recently. So some of the policy objectives that are also in the statute include making sure that Minnesota has a certain amount of energy conservation. And what we're finding is that in the region, Minnesota is being seen as a leader of energy conservation that is a resource that plays into an energy market that is run by the Midwest Independent System Operator. So we're finding that there is value in the forward-thinking policy that Minnesota has had in place for years. The policy objectives have been also right now creating real jobs in energy conservation, in renewable energy, and in building transmission. So they're engineering jobs, construction jobs. We're building on Minnesota's current renewable energy resources, making that stronger, making sure that our valuable energy efficiency resources continue to be maintained and grow, strengthening our transmission sources, because transmission is a key no matter what policy you have. It's a critical resource for us to have in Minnesota, and protecting the public health and the environment. So in short, Minnesota policy is looking to build an energy system for the 21st century that's efficient, reliable, sustainable, and affordable. 216H is a very good example of how Minnesota balances economic and social goals. Of course, 216H03 is intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and that's intended primarily to protect the public health and the environment. But it does more than that from an economic point of view. It protects Minnesota consumers from the risk of paying higher rates should there be a federal greenhouse gas regulation. Being ahead of the curve gives Minnesota a competitive edge because it gives us more flexibility and it gives us more assets should there ever be greenhouse gas carbon regulation at the federal level. But very wisely, 216H balances even this goal against other concerns. For example, if any plant in Minnesota or elsewhere can show that it is essential for long-term reliability of the system, that it's needed for an industrial development, or that it's necessary to avoid placing a substantial burden on ratepayers, that plant can request an exemption from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. So it's not an absolute prohibition, it's a prohibition that has an out, has off-ramps. And even if a plant can't meet those criteria, it can still propose a carbon offset plan. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission just referred Minnesota's first carbon offset plan to an administrative law judge so that we can develop the facts and bring the issues to the commission so that they'll be able to decide what do we mean when we try to apply this law? What does it mean in practice? And there's always that issue of we pass a law, and now what does it mean in practice? And that depends on the facts of the case that's in front of the commission. So that process is going forward.
Ms. O'Connell, I just want to understand. I think you said your presentation was going to be about 5 minutes long, and I'm just wondering if you're close to wrapping it up.
I'm close to wrapping it up.
Thank you. Go ahead.
All I wanted to say basically was that it's not, the social values are not either or. We're finding that as we implement the next generation that we're actually having benefits for Minnesota. If you're interested in seeing where our energy comes from, I'd be glad to show you a graph that shows how much comes from coal, nuclear, and other kinds of resources. But if now isn't the time to do that, that's fine.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Questions for the Commissioner? Thank you. If the advocates could come down, and I understand your presentation's about 15 minutes long, so the staff here will let you know if you get close to the end by holding up a sign for you to remind you of the timing. So thank you, and introduce yourself as you come forward.
Morning, everyone. I'm Eric Olson, Vice President and General Counsel of Great River Energy. For those of you who don't know Great River, we are a generation and transmission electric cooperative headquartered in Maple Grove, Minnesota. We serve 28 Minnesota electric distribution cooperatives who in turn serve member consumers who make up about one-third of Minnesota's population and about two-thirds of Minnesota's geographic area. I'm here to express Great River Energy's support for the passage of House File 72, which would repeal the Next Gen Act's restrictions on new coal-fired power plants. As Representative Beard said, I think very eloquently, although the economic downturn has slowed growth in the use of electricity, that could turn around in a very short time, and we would need cost-effective baseload generation. And given the difficulties with nuclear, coal really is the best option, or can be. Why would we want to prohibit what might be the best option at the time that we need more power? And why would we want to prohibit or make more costly new power plants that are much cleaner and more efficient than existing plants? In addition, we think regulation of greenhouse gases is a national issue. Minnesota shouldn't go it alone. Why put Minnesota's competitiveness at risk with no benefit in return when other states have not followed suit? In addition, one of the current provisions of the law bars importation of electricity from new coal plants in other states. We don't think it makes sense to classify something made in one state of the union as an import and place restrictions or additional costs on its use in another state. When we say we're part of the United States, one of the things we mean is that we are united in commerce. Finally, the existing statute has several issues and ambiguities that make determining how to plan for complying with it impossible. The most significant issue, but far from the only one with the statute, relates to the statutory provision that allows utilities to offset CO2 emission reductions from existing facilities against CO2 emissions from new plants that are subject to the statute. As Ms. O'Connell pointed out, Great River Energy is in the very early stages of a proceeding at the PUC regarding our plan to offset emissions at our new Spiritwood Station coal-fired combined heat and power plant near Jamestown, North Dakota. Construction of Spiritwood is complete, and we expect it to go online January 1st, 2012. Spiritwood is a 99-megawatt plant that generates electricity, but it also produces steam to provide the energy needs of Cargill's adjacent malting facility under a 30-year contract. Great River Energy built Spiritwood starting in 2007 because we anticipated we would need baseload energy and also to take advantage of the unique opportunity to combine electric generation with the production of steam for Cargill, which was searching for a more stable energy solution than natural gas. Spiritwood is a state-of-the-art facility, and it was built during the recession with the help of Minnesota contractors and many Minnesota workers. When Spiritwood's steam capacity is fully subscribed, it will emit CO2 at about the same rate as gas-fired peaking plants, which are exempt from the statute. In addition, because Spiritwood uses best available pollution control technology, its SO2 and NOx emissions will be a small fraction of those at some older coal-fired plants, and particulate emissions will be completely controlled. Great River Energy has reduced our CO2 emissions from other facilities by an amount that is more than sufficient to offset CO2 emissions from Spiritwood. We expected we would be able to use these offsets when we chose to go forward with Spiritwood after the statute was passed in 2007. But no one can agree about what the statute's unclearly written offset provisions mean. So the PUC has referred the matter to a contested case hearing. We expect resolution of that case will take at least a year, but it's also a case that could go to the court system and last multiple years. If Great River Energy's offset plan isn't approved, we will have to purchase CO2 allowances from the regional CO2 markets in California or Northeast in order to offset the emissions from Spiritwood. What's worse is that we have no idea how much these allowances will cost at the time that we have to purchase them over the next several years or decades of the life of the plant. The total cost to Minnesota Electric Co-op member consumers could rise to $20 million per year. Great River Energy believes that such a wealth transfer from Minnesotans makes no sense. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Next, is it Mr. Jones, or who's next? If you could identify yourself and give us your presentation. Thank you. We'll take questions from the group when they're done.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Mike Jones, and I hold the position of Vice President of Research and Development for the Lignite Energy Council and serve as Director and Technical Representative for the State of North Dakota's Lignite Research Development and Marketing Program. My PhD is in physics from the University of North Dakota. I worked 30 years with the Energy and Environmental Research Center, commonly known as the EERC, in Grand Forks. My career there focused on research and development of clean and efficient energy technology systems so Upper Midwest residents and businesses can use the abundant coal resources of our state and country. The Lignite Energy Council is a regional trade association representing lignite producers who sell about 30 million tons of lignite annually. Utilities which generate affordable, reliable electricity for 2 million people in our region, and businesses that provide goods and services accounting for nearly $3 billion in gross business volume. As you all know, an ample supply of affordable energy is crucial to the economic growth of any state. North Dakota's lignite industry provides electricity to customers in more than two-thirds of Minnesota. Much of this territory is served by rural and suburban electric distribution cooperatives and municipal utilities. It is important to note that North Dakota delivers low-cost, reliable electricity from lignite. We also do it in a manner which is compatible with federal environmental standards. The owners of the power plants have also invested approximately $1.7 billion in emission control technologies to reduce pollutants regulated by the federal EPA. The result is that North Dakota is one of only 12 states in the nation, along with Minnesota, that meets all the federal ambient air quality standards. We also consistently receive an A grade from the American Lung Association for our air quality. The state of North Dakota is an active financial partner with the lignite industry in research and development projects to further reduce emissions and improve efficiencies. The money invested by the state comes from a tax collected on every ton of lignite mined. Since 1987, the state of North Dakota has invested more than $60 million in 150-plus lignite research and development projects, totaling a value of more than $570 million. Currently, the state has leveraged $8 million to support over $180 million in projects to advance technologies to capture and store carbon dioxide from power plants. The largest R&D project in this group is called the Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership, or PCOR. It is partially funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. Many of the Lignite Energy Council members, along with the state of North Dakota, are involved with PCOR, which has as its goal identifying, quantifying, and determining the technical feasibility and economic costs of various CO2 storage technologies in 9 Midwestern states and 3 Canadian provinces. North Dakota is also home to the world's largest carbon capture project. The Great Plains Synfuels plant uses gasification technology to make synthetic natural gas from lignite. Approximately 8,500 tons of CO2 per day are captured and transported to Canadian oil firms. The gas is used for enhanced oil recovery in partially depleted oil fields near Weyburn, Saskatchewan. While the technology between the Synfuels plant and a power plant are substantially different, the lignite industry has existing infrastructure that can be used to move CO2 once it can be economically captured from the power plants. In addition, an $80,000 investment by the state has resulted in the sale of almost all the fly ash produced by Great River Energy's Coal Creek Station. What once was a waste product is now sold as a replacement for Portland cement and making a durable concrete. In fact, that fly ash from North Dakota was used in rebuilding the I-35 bridge. This has resulted in a savings of about one ton of CO2 for every ton of Portland cement, which has been replaced by fly ash. The benefits to Minnesota from the regional lignite industry include access to low-cost, reliable electricity. That's good for job creation in all corners of the state. There are also more than 70 Minnesota companies that provide direct goods and services to the mines and plants. Some provide the labor required for scheduled outages to clean boilers, rewire turbines, and paint the exteriors of equipment and plants. Others provide materials such as conveyors, instrumentation, and fire prevention systems. Often these companies sell the same products and services to Minnesota utilities or Minnesota mining companies, resulting in more regional economic activity. We believe the energy partnership between the lignite industry and the state of Minnesota has been mutually rewarding. It makes sense for Minnesota to continue this energy partnership that has not only allowed it to meet the customer needs, but allows your state to be among the industry leaders in investing, researching, and developing better technologies that result in reduced emissions, increased efficiencies, and the power needed to build a stronger Minnesota economy. On behalf of the members of the Lignite Energy Council, we encourage you to pass this legislation and continue this energy partnership between our states. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. We'll wait to question the group as a whole. Ms. Seifert.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Bride Seifert, and I'm the Energy Policy Manager for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We've got over 2,300 business members, and that represents about 500,000 jobs in Minnesota. We're asking you today to support House File 72. Currently, Minnesota utilities don't have the opportunity to import new or build new plants in our state that use our state's largest source of power, and that's coal. As you've heard before, we believe that Minnesota utilities need all of their options on the table. The Office of Administrative Hearings, the PUC, and the utilities can do a great job of figuring out what's the right mix for Minnesota's energy portfolio if we let them. We're always going to need reliable, affordable baseload power, and that's what coal is. Removing the ban on coal allows Minnesota's complete energy portfolio to continue developing. That portfolio is going to be a mix: renewables, coal, nuclear, gas, and hydro. Continuing to close doors on these options, especially proven, cost-effective, long-term options, just shackles our utilities and sends the wrong message to businesses. Businesses want and look for reliable, affordable energy. We ask you to support House File 72.
Thank you, Ms. Seifert. Mr. Melander.
Chairman McNamara, committee members, my name is Harry Melander. I'm the chair of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. Our organization, as I've said before in front of the committee, represents close to 50,000 Minnesotans. Unfortunately, over 30% of those are unemployed. Our organization, not only local here but on a national level, continues to support energy options, not only as we are today, but as we've done on the committee last week. We believe that the restriction of importing power is something that would restrict opportunities for Minnesotans. Many of you are aware of our comments that we've made over the last 2 to 3 years, but those employment opportunities that existed because of the power generating industry in North Dakota and other heavy industries really created opportunities for Minnesotans, and our unemployment within the construction industry would have been much worse. As we mentioned 2 weeks ago about what our organization is calling our energy menu, we think the use of coal should be on the table. We understand the concerns that different groups have, not only locally but nationally, but we think having that energy menu as broad as it can be will create options for power producing industries, and more importantly, create jobs for Minnesotans and for those unfortunate Minnesotans that have to travel to other parts of our country. We support this bill. We hope it moves forward.
Well, Mr. Melander, as being one of those that spent time in a motel room in a different state in my job as we traveled around to go where the work was in the construction trade, I understand those folks that traveled much over the last couple of years to work on the power plants and the gas fields of North Dakota and the struggle with being away from their families. And so we're glad that they were working, many of them, but we wish they could have been working closer to home. Questions for the group? Representative Fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I've got a few questions, and I guess the first one I'll pose to the entirety of the testifiers. And I'm a little bit confused by the support for this, because essentially there are offsets and there are exemptions for essential or essentially needed facilities that the PUC can deem essential. I haven't seen those procedures used yet. I haven't seen one of those off-ramps applied for. So essentially, you're lobbying for non-essential power, which ends up raising everybody's rates. So I'm just curious, how do we reconcile that?
I'll take that question.
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Two things.
Mr. Olson, if I could just tell you how it works. It's Mr. Chair, Representative Falk. If you don't know his name and you can't see the label, you can just refer to it Mr. Chair, Representative. And just so that we all are aware, and so the audience, I'm speaking mostly to the rest of the audience. Some people may get hung up on that, but it's kind of a formal process, and so then we can keep working that way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Falk. First, with respect to the offsets, as I covered in my testimony, the offset provisions are hopelessly ambiguous and really quite difficult to comply with. And really uncertain. So we're going to be possibly in court for several years on that. With respect to the exemption provision is written so stringently that it makes it uncertain whether any power plant could comply. And what we would say is that the integrated resource plan process and the certificate of need process are really the right ways to decide whether plant is right for Minnesota.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson, I happen to just disagree a little bit. I was looking at one of the dockets that GRE filed with respect to the Spiritwood plant, and in the comments provided, it said that less than 25% of the energy would be used for Minnesota. And because there was, I guess, I don't think it was that ambiguous that the PUC was going to look at continued the if there would be need for another docket to go and look at what your resource requirements were. But I think that the comments provided that there was multiple options for what GRE could do essentially to reduce emissions, and I think the process is working very well. So I don't see, at least in the comments provided by GRE in that docket, how it was that ambiguity, or that level of ambiguity that you alluded to. And so I'm just trying to reconcile the two.
Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Falk. It's true that initially Great River Energy's member consumers won't need all of the output of the Spiritwood plant. That's not what we anticipated when we committed to build the plant in 2007 before the recession. But one doesn't build a 30 or 40 year base load power plant for the next business cycle.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Follow up, Representative Falk.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some issue with the lack of foresight, perhaps. And I don't want to direct all my comments directly at GRE, but we are talking about a GRE plant here, that where is the plan B? We know that this is a plant that's being built in North Dakota. I don't see Minnesota jobs being created within our borders with this plant. I do see that North Dakota resources, you know, essentially being planned to be shipped here. I also look at this as being a somewhat expensive facility. I think that a plan B, or maybe something that I would have appreciated seeing offered, would have been like a natural gas plant to back up additional wind generation built in Minnesota. When you're talking about 50 megawatts here out of a 99 megawatt plant, which is still a quite small plant, I think that there's the ability to have used very standard natural gas technology, very standardized wind technology built in state at actually a much more reasonable cost. Granted, the natural gas has some variability in its costs, but right now we've seen that is one of the lowest cost resources. And so I think that a little bit more foresight, instead of trying to go and change, I think, good legislation that really sets Minnesota at the forefront of emissions control, conservation, efficiency, and renewable development for 50 megawatts of power, potentially, of which less than 25% under current docket is slated for Minnesota. I think that's just very short and lacks a lot of the... It goes in against what Minnesota is trying to establish itself as a renewable energy leader.
Representative Falk, was that just a comment, or was there a question for one of the testifiers?
That was a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Falk. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Seifert, the Chamber of Commerce has been well aware that the Twin Cities metro area has been on the cusp of not making attainment for fine particulate matter. And so the Chamber has worked with a clean energy group and has promoted things like the green fleets and done a lot of work to keep us in attainment. Credit to the Chamber for that. However, we see, because of the health costs of fine particulate matter and medical science telling us that fine particulate is extraordinarily expensive, that the standards are likely to be somewhat more restrictive to protect health care costs, and that Minnesota will no longer meet the fine particulate standard. So, probably even without new coal coming in, but if we have new coal coming in, and of course, even if it's in another state, the precursor chemicals and the fine particulates move, because a lot of why we're out of compliance is because of what's coming in, or will be out of compliance, is coming in from other states. So if we were to adopt your proposal, Minnesota, the rest of Minnesota businesses would need to lower their emissions in order to meet the fine particulate standard. Let me just think of 3M, which actually wants to expand burning here, would be required to have less emissions. Is 3M okay with this particular proposal to expand coal, and it has already agreed then to reduce its emissions in order to have more coal?
Ms. Seifert, are you prepared to speak for 3M? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair McNamara. Mm-hmm. Representative Wagenius, I am not prepared to speak for them. They are part of our membership, and let me assure you that our policies are developed with the scope of our membership giving input. So I cannot speak for 3M, but I can speak for the Chamber. Thank
Follow
you.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Well, I think we need...
Representative Wagenius, remember.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius.
Ms. Seifert, I think we need to hear from some of our businesses that are located in Minnesota that do have emissions, that will have to reduce those emissions to accommodate new coal. And I think that's important that we hear that they are willing to do that.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius.
We'd like to hear back from them. At some point, I think we need to know, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. So, one for Mr. Olson regarding the Spiritwood plant. I think Great River Energy was paying attention to what was going on when the Next Generation Energy Act was passed, and if the chair would indulge me, I'd just like to reflect on that act for a moment. As you are aware, I was considerably involved in that and was present when the bill was signed, and I would like to let the committee know what Governor Pawlenty had to say at the time that he signed the bill that actually he initiated, although I was the chief house author. What he said was the best time to have taken action on energy issues would have been 30 years ago. The second best time is right now. The nation has been asleep at the switch. But here in Minnesota, we're kickstarting the future by increasing our nation-leading per capita renewable fuel use, boosting cost-saving measures, and tackling greenhouse gas emissions. Now, Mr. Olson, I'm sure you're aware that when this bill was put together, interested parties came forward and said that it would have implications for projects that they already had in process. And the bill included exemptions for actually anyone who asked for one. There was an exemption made for Big Stone 2, which Great River was a partner in at the time. There was an exemption made for Excelsior Energy, which still is in place. Incidentally, Representative Beard, and there's the potential there for at least 600 megawatts of coal-fired electricity within the state of Minnesota should any demand for that electricity arise, according to my conversations recently with Excelsior. The problem they're having is that there is no demand. But Mr. Olson, I'm wondering why, when it was obvious that interested parties were coming forward and saying we need an exemption because we already have this in our planning process and our ongoing resource planning, why did Great River Energy not do that at the time when you had the opportunity to?
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, Spiritwood was in its planning stages, hadn't been committed to it at that time, and we took a look at the provisions of the statute and thought that that the offset and other provisions, and including federal preemption and the like, would be adequate, and time has shown that that's becoming more difficult.
Another question, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have some comments later, but I have a question for Dr. Jones. The issue of coal from North Dakota has been around for a while. I had the opportunity to meet with the Attorney General of the state of North Dakota, as well as the Governor's Chief of Staff and a number of representatives of the lignite industry in North Dakota more than a year ago. And what they represented the North Dakota coal business as at the time as being exceptional in the way that you have done this morning. And what I said at the time is that sounded very interesting. I was interested in what standards you were able to maintain in production in North Dakota, and suggested that, as we had for other parties and for various reasons, if we knew exactly what production and how it differed from production in North Dakota differed from that in other states and other facilities, perhaps as we have done for other entities, we could alter the statute to accommodate that higher achievement that you referenced. And at the time, the Attorney General and the other members of that delegation said they would be happy to provide me with that information. I said as soon as I got it, we would see if we could find some way to accommodate that those conditions and perhaps carve out something that would be specific to any entity that was capable of meeting those higher standards. And so far, I haven't heard anything back from North Dakota. Have you been involved in that discussion? Is there still something forthcoming in that?
Dr. Jones.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, I have not.
Follow-up, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, there has been distributed a graph showing Minnesota's electric consumption. There's no indication of who distributed that. And I guess it doesn't matter.
Representative Hilty, just one second. If the pages I see on the bottom, it's the Minnesota Department of Commerce. It's Representative Beard passed it out, Representative Hilty. Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I think it's interesting that this stops with the year 2000, which is more than 10 years ago. And I would just point out to the committee that the ratio of electricity growth per unit of economic growth has declined enormously over the past few decades. Before 1973, the ratio of electricity growth to gross domestic product was about 2 to 1. Between 1973 and 1993, it was about 1 to 1. From 93 to 2000, it was about 2/3 to 1. And up to 2008, it was 0.55 to 1. To assume that increasing economic activity is going to result in a comparable increase in demand for electricity totally ignores efficiency. It totally ignores the trends that have clearly been in place over the past few decades, and I suspect that that's why we're not looking at Minnesota electric consumption from 2000 to 2010. I will have more to say later, Mr. Chair, but that's it for now.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for Ms. Seifert or Mr. Melander, I'm not sure, or anyone who can answer. We've heard the arguments that we want to make sure every energy option is on the table, that Minnesota shouldn't prohibit any option, that why would we put Minnesota's economy at risk when other states aren't doing it? But Minnesota's own Office of Energy Security has been telling it gave us information about how we are both meeting 21st century clean energy needs and realizing economic benefits as a result. And I'm just curious if either of you have information about where job growth has been in the energy sector, where people are on the ground working to meet these dual goals. And I think these are both important goals of economic development and addressing our 21st century energy and climate challenges. And from the information I have, green jobs and clean energy jobs are places we're seeing growth. And I agree with Mr. Olson when he said wealth transfer out of the state of Minnesota for energy doesn't make any sense. He was specifically referring to carbon allowances. I would think North Dakota is one of the few states that actually has a surplus in their budget. They probably don't need our money for their coal, but we could sure use it to put Minnesotans to work making the 21st century energy economy here in Minnesota. And we transfer a whole lot of wealth out of the state of Minnesota because the only few sources we have are solar and wind. We don't have uranium, we don't have coal, we don't have natural gas. We have some small hydro, which we're using. We don't have large hydro. And so I'm just curious if you have any information or could get us any information about where jobs are actually growing in this state, particularly in the energy industry.
Mr. Melander.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you're absolutely correct that those limited opportunities within the energy producing industry are with what we'll call wind in those green energy sources that I believe that you're referencing. We're here today as an organization and as an institution to say that we support all of those opportunities, and we appreciate, because of the hard work, as I've indicated a couple of weeks ago, that you all have done over the past years have created those jobs. But we as an organization truly believe that Minnesotans will make good decisions, but Minnesotans need to have all of those energy options on the table when, in fact, those opportunities come in front of us. But to be somewhat repetitive, you're absolutely right that those opportunities, which are we're appreciative of, but very, very limited, are in those energy sources that you referenced.
Any follow-up?
I can provide, excuse me.
Go ahead, Mr. Melander.
I can provide you with some data referring to that, referencing that.
Mr. Melander, if you could provide the committee with that data when you get it, that'd be great. Any follow-up, Representative Knute? Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the panel, I've been looking at the bill, and I noticed that the repealers are longer than the bill. And, you know, we've heard quite a bit this session about reform, but it appears that reform is repeal, you know, that the bills that are coming in front of us are repeal, repeal, repeal. And it looks like, you know, there was kind of extensive reform a couple years ago, trying to create the new green economy, trying to keep jobs in Minnesota. And so I'm not sure if repeal is that creative. It seems to be a reaction rather than a reform. And I'm trying to look at where is the creativity? Where do we go here? Do we just go back in time and focus on what we've always focused on and hope it keeps working? Or do we try to look at new things? Do we try to build new ideas in this for new generation of Minnesotans? That's what I'm looking for, rather than just saying no, repeal, going backwards, repeal, 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 rather than actual reform. So I'd like your ideas on that. Where is the creativity? Where do we create new jobs? How do we use energy better in 2011?
Dr. Jones.
Well, I can't speak for what Minnesota is doing. I can speak for what we're doing in my home state of North Dakota. And I think that as we look to the future, we are developing new technologies that will make use of the most plentiful natural resource we have in the U.S., which is coal, and doing it in an environmentally acceptable way. And that is creating new opportunities and new jobs.
Mr. Olson, could you expand on, you mentioned something about you're recovering the steam. What was that about? Something about Cargill and an expansion at a malting plant. 30-year contract. I'm not aware of. Do other coal plants do something like that? What's that about?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Spiritwood is a combined heat and power facility. And what that means is it generates electricity, but it also generates steam for adjacent industrial uses. And so Spiritwood was designed to provide steam for Cargill's malting plant in Jamestown, North Dakota.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Follow-up, Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and members, well, I don't think there's any new coal being created. In burning coal, you're releasing the carbon dioxide that seems to be what has an impact on our overall planet. And so the renewability seems to be adding more problems that we have to provide cost for to react to the impacts of increased carbon dioxide emissions. So I don't think we're making any more new coal, but we continue to make more we continue to release more carbon dioxide, which has an impact on overall climate.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. I believe it would be for Mr. Olson. And with all the concerns about CO2, and that is a big concern for all of us, I have a concern also about burning coal and mercury release. And do you have a number that you're aware of on the Spiritwood plant and what mercury emissions would be coming from that, and then it's over to here with the air movement in northern hemisphere the way we know it? Do you know what the number is, how many pounds of mercury per year out of your Spiritwood plant?
Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I don't have the number for that. But
Mr. Olson, if you could get that information to the committee, unless someone in the audience is with you that may know it, that would be great. Representative Purcell.
Mr. Chair, well, we did a little bit of calculating, and this is...
Representative Purcell, if you know the answer to your question, could you provide it to the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to
thank
talk
you.
About
Representative Purcell.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Olson, just running some calculations and that we are aware of, and I'm not intending to be precise to the gram here, but it looks like about 120 pounds a year, approximately up to. And
Representative Purcell, could you get that information to the rest of the committee? That'd be great.
May I continue, Mr. Chair?
You sure can, Mr. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what I'm concerned about here, Mr. Chair, is we have a pretty aggressive policy on mercury reductions. And I'm looking at a report here from it's called Air Quality in Minnesota, 2011 report to the legislature from Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And we're talking about electricity consumed in Minnesota but produced outside the state, resulting in an additional 1,926 pounds of mercury emissions in the 2 years, 08 and 09. Well, that was an increase in 34 pounds of mercury from outside the state, Mr. Chair. And my concern, coming from where I come from in the state, is about mercury in the fish, and that we don't have fish, a lot of fish in our lakes up there that women of childbearing age can't eat, according to our Minnesota Department of Health. And yet we're going to put more mercury into the atmosphere. It's going to come over here to Minnesota. How in blue blazes are we ever going to get where we can eat the fish again? That's my concern. And I don't think coal's the answer in this. I just want to make that point that I think we have more issues than CO2. Mercury's a big issue up in my neck of the woods. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Thank you, testifiers. Next, we're going to hear from the opponents of the bill. I believe we have Ms. Lang from the Isaac Walton League, Ms. Freeze from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Mr. Hunter from the American Lung Association. If you could all come down, and we look forward to your testimony.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for us to begin?
You know, if you could speak louder into the mic and identify yourself, okay, and then go ahead with your presentation. Thank okay. you.
Good morning. My name is Nancy Lang, and I am a staff person with the Isaac Walton League of America. I've worked for many years on their clean energy programs, and I'm here testifying today on behalf of the Isaac Walton League, but also on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, whose 80 member organizations and 450,000 members are populated across our state. As we've heard this morning, the Next Generation Act passed in 2007 with broad bipartisan support. It was strongly supported by Governor Pawlenty, and it was strongly supported because it was good policy for Minnesota. The clean energy policies passed in 2007 have directed investments in local clean energy resources, which are already supporting job creation and economic development in Minnesota communities. And I urge the committee, we've had some discussion this morning about types of jobs and numbers of jobs. I urge the committee at some point in the future to hold a hearing to learn more about the jobs that are occurring as a result of these policies. It's important, I think, to be really clear about what this particular provision of the Next Generation Act does and does not do. It is not a moratorium on coal. It does not ban the construction of new coal projects either within Minnesota or outside our borders. In reality, if there is any moratorium on coal, it is coming from the decisions being made in the financial sector and by the utilities themselves. Costs to construct and operate new coal plants have risen sharply in recent years, including steep increases in the cost of coal itself. And for the second year in a row, construction did not begin on a single new coal plant anywhere in the United States. And my colleague Barb Fries will be addressing these factors in more detail in just a few minutes. Really, the coal provisions in the Act were put in place to ensure that Minnesota does not backslide on its commitments to reduce the pollution that damages our health and the natural systems on which we depend. In 2007, legislators understood that it made no sense to lock into long-term increases in pollution while at the same time accelerating investments in clean resources like wind and energy efficiency, abundant local resources that are being developed to benefit Minnesotans. Minnesotans support this common sense approach. Every year, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership does polling, which they use a bipartisan research team to conduct. And in November of this past year, when they polled on this question, 70% of Minnesota voters believe this policy on new coal should remain in law, and that support was strong across both Republican and Democratic voters. The process set out in law is working as it should. We've heard from Great River Energy a little bit about this process. The PUC held a hearing just last week to start to examine how the Spiritwood plant would offset its emissions. Qualifying offset projects by utilities could lower emissions while saving ratepayers from the higher costs of new coal. And I think it's very important for the legislature to let this process go forward. They are questions that are being confronted for the first time by the Public Utilities Commission, but I think the law is clear, and I think parties will be able to sort this out in a timely fashion. And as noted, the PUC can also make a determination that a project should be exempt from these requirements under certain conditions. We've heard some reference to integrated resource plans this morning, and the importance of that planning process for ratepayers, for our economic stability in the state. And so I think it is important to look at the utilities resource plans with respect to coal. No other Minnesota utilities are planning to invest in new coal projects. They have been very clear in their most recent resource plans that they are not interested in new commitments to coal. Instead, utilities are meeting their baseload needs with a balanced combination of resources. And I do underline the word balanced. Uprates to two existing nuclear power plants, new hydropower from Canada, and natural gas, wind, and energy efficiency. The combination of gas, wind, and energy efficiency is proving less expensive with shorter construction and permitting lead times and more flexible operation. It would also be instructive to examine the excess capacity that currently exists in the natural gas generation capacity in the Midwest. You know, we do have excess capacity available through natural gas plants that are already existing. Coal plants are not compatible with the new generation of energy technologies. Xcel Energy has noted that as the amount of wind energy in its system grows, its preferred alternative is to support the wind resources with natural gas generation, a more flexible and low-cost alternative than new coal. For all these reasons, the Isaac Walton League and the members of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership oppose House File 72.
Thank you, Ms. Lang, for your testimony, and we'll take questions from the group when they're done. Ms. Fries?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Fries. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists, where I worked on coal-related issues for a number of years. Let me start just by stressing why the provisions of the existing law, which we think should not be repealed, remain important. Coal plants are the nation's and Minnesota's largest single source of carbon dioxide emissions that are threatening our climate. The nation's coal plants emit more than all of its cars and trucks, all forms of surface transportation combined. And a single coal plant can easily emit as much carbon dioxide as hundreds of thousands of cars every year. And of course, coal plants last for decades. And because I represent a science-based organization, let me take a moment to address the science of climate. In 2009, the National Academy of Sciences said, and I quote, "The need for urgent action to address climate change is now indisputable." It is rare that scientists, who are a cautious bunch in general, speak this strongly and this clearly about this kind of an issue. But the National Academy has essentially made this point over and over again in a series of reports, as have the other leading scientific associations in this country and indeed around the world. And I know that not all members of this committee agree with the National Academy of Sciences on this particular point in question, in this particular scientific question. But I do believe it is very important that you are aware of these warnings, because Minnesota cannot afford to ignore them. The need to cut our carbon emissions dramatically has not receded since 2007. On the contrary. And of course, the provisions that House File 72 would repeal, they will not cut our emissions. They are an anti-backsliding provision that will essentially keep us from locking in to emission-increasing technology while we're trying to achieve the goals of emission reduction set forth in the law. One point I would like to make is that the definition of the statewide carbon dioxide emissions already excludes any CO2 that is actually sequestered underground. So to the extent that carbon capture and storage that you've heard discussed today could put that CO2 underground and keep it there, those tons of CO2 would not need to be offset. So the existing law, I think, actually helps encourage that sort of technological development rather than impeding it. On the question of the costs of the existing law, it would be a mistake to assume that the language of the law is preventing Minnesotans from investing in coal plants that would otherwise be economically attractive. First of all, of course, it isn't actually preventing new coal plants. It just requires compensating pollution reductions elsewhere. But I want to talk more about why investing in coal plants is such a bad idea from a financial perspective as well as an environmental one. New coal plants are now so expensive that they simply cannot compete with other cleaner options. Over the last few years, most of the coal plant proposals around the country were canceled or rejected because their prices had risen so dramatically. And of course, that includes the Big Stone 2 power plant in our own backyard, which was canceled by its backers, not because of this law from which it was exempt, but because the financial risks of such a costly project proved too high. Those cost increases are shown in the data and the forecasts of the Federal Energy Information Administration. The EIA has a detailed computer model. They can put in the costs of all the energy options available to us, and then that model will predict what utilities and others will build based on what is most economic. As recently as 2006, the EIA was projecting the construction of about 240 new coal plants in this country by 2030. Now, because of the cost increases associated with new coal plants, EIA's computer model no longer projects the construction of any new coal plants by 2030, apart from those already under construction, which they assume will be finished, and a few carbon capture and storage demonstration projects, which they assume will go forward with federal subsidies. And the reason those new coal plants have disappeared from the federal projections are their skyrocketing costs. In 2006, the EIA estimated that electricity from new coal plants would cost only 5.3 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, the EIA estimates that the cost of electricity from new coal plants, and this would be a plant coming online in 2015, which is about when a plant that has not yet been proposed would come online, has more than doubled to 11.8 cents per kilowatt hour. And by way of comparison, energy from new wind projects coming online in our part of the country over the last few years, and so the time is a little off here, but I think this is still a useful comparison, have on average sold for about 4.5 cents per kilowatt hour, or less than half the projected price of power from new coal plants. And as another point of comparison, the average retail price of electricity in Minnesota is 7.8 cents per kilowatt hour. So at 11.8 cents, the wholesale cost of energy from new coal plants would be about 50% higher than the average retail price Minnesotans pay today. And importantly, this 11.8 cent cost of electricity from new coal plants does not include a carbon component. It does not include the price of future restrictions on CO2. And of course, we failed to pass a law last session of Congress putting the price on carbon, but that kind of a law remains widely expected, certainly within the operating lifetime, and I would say very early in the operating lifetime of a new coal plant. So that law would raise the costs further. These numbers also do not fully reflect the possibility of the price of coal itself going up dramatically, and if members of the committee have questions, I can address that more. Let me also just note, there's been discussion of wealth transfer out of Minnesota. Let me note that Minnesota right now already spends about half $1 billion a year importing coal into the state to be burned in its power plants. Any new coal plant would, of course, just increase the dollars that are drained out of our state economy, and dollars that we could keep here and invest in energy and efficiency instead, or in our wealth of renewable resources. So in conclusion, let me just say that the anti-backsliding provisions of House File, of the existing law, the provisions that House File 72 seeks to repeal remain important to avoid pollution increases, but they also are having the effect of protecting Minnesota ratepayers and its economy, and so we urge the committee to keep the existing law intact.
Thank you, Ms. Fries. Mr. Hunter.
Thank you, Chairman McNamara. Members, good morning. My name is John Hunter. I'm with the American Lung Association in Minnesota. Our mission is to save lives by protecting lung health and preventing lung disease. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I just want to speak briefly about some of the major negative health consequences of some of the pollutants mentioned earlier in today's testimony that come from the result of burning of coal. As you may know, the burning of coal creates or results in a wide variety of pollutants, but I'll focus here primarily on major ones impacting Minnesotans, including nitrogen oxides, often called NOx, sulfur dioxides, SO2, ozone, and particulate matter. Commonly, these are often sort of grouped together as smog and soot. These pollutants have a tremendous health impact on the people of Minnesota. Exposure to these pollutants can result in increased respiratory symptoms, such as irritation of airways, coughing, difficulty breathing, decreased lung function, chest pain, aggravated asthma, development of chronic bronchitis, increased susceptibility to respiratory infections, such as influenza, increased emergency room visits and hospital admissions for respiratory problems, and premature death in people with heart and lung disease. People most likely to be affected by these pollutants include children, teens, older adults, and people with chronic lung diseases like asthma, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, and others. Last year, the National Academy of Science released a report entitled The Hidden Costs of Energy, Unpriced Consequences of Energy Production and Use. In that, they estimated the impacted costs of generating electricity from coal that's caused by the nitrogen oxides, the sulfur dioxides, and the particulate matter. According to their data, the pollution coming from Minnesota coal plants caused almost $600 million worth of impact in 2007. The National Academy of Science says on average around the nation, 94% of the costs that come from these pollutants comes as a result of premature mortality, people dying before they would have otherwise had they not been exposed to these pollutants. If you extrapolate from that, their numbers and the cost of Minnesota coal plants, we can roughly estimate that approximately 78 people would die each year prematurely as a result of Minnesota's coal plant pollution. Impacting the increased burning of coal would also result both in more air pollution and a greater economic impact. As Representative Wagenius has mentioned earlier, Minnesota is kind of on the precipice of violating the Clean Air Act standards for ozone. This would bring strong economic consequences. In 1999, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce estimated that complying with the regulatory requirements triggered by falling out of compliance on ozone would cost the citizens and businesses of Minnesota up to $266 million a year. Again, that's just in 1999 dollars. The state and our business and nonprofit communities have been working hard on voluntary efforts for the past decade to try to prevent losing what they call attainment under the Clean Air Act for ozone. But any increase in ozone that would come from increased coal burning, be it originating in Minnesota or other states and blowing in, will weaken the efforts that we've been doing for the past past decade to try to prevent these federal interventions. While also harming the health of Minnesotans. So with that, I think we stand
ready for
questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in those statistics from the National Academy of Science about increased health care costs. Is there a way, Mr. Chair, if we could get a link to that or maybe an abstract of the study so we could see that in a little more detail?
Good question, Representative Hansen. Ms. Fries, do you have access to that information? I believe it was you that mentioned it.
Actually, I do have access to that, although if you're specifically referring to the health and death information from Mr. Turner, I assume you would have that as well.
Chairman McNamara, I'd be happy to send a link along.
Do either one of the testifiers have it with them today in a hard copy? Okay, if you could send us that electronically, and we'll forward it to the members. Thank you for being here today. First, we're next going to hear from the citizens. I believe somebody have a question? Okay. Next, we're going to hear there was some citizens from Stillwater High School, some students. Are they here this morning? I've got Norgargan. I probably went all over. I'm not Norwegian. I'm Irish and German, so I apologize. If you could come forward. Give us your name and who you're here on behalf of, and we'd like to give you a couple of minutes to testify and then allow time for questions. We have at least 8 citizens that would like to testify, and I would like to give room to all of them. I know some of you have cut class, and we certainly don't want you to have to cut class again for those of us that have been there before. If you could identify yourself for the record, and then go to it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cole Norgarden. I am a 10th grader at the Blake School in Minneapolis, and I am also co-chair of Youth Environmental Activists of Minnesota, on which I am speaking on behalf of today. And as a young person, I am in opposition of House File 72, which would lift a ban on carbon dioxide emissions produced by utilities in Minnesota. Lifting this ban is undoing progress we have made towards achieving energy sustainability in Minnesota. This is not a mistake we can afford to make with the futures of youth like myself at stake. We refuse to inherit the costs coal imposes on Minnesota's communities, both environmental and economic, costs we will have to deal with if carbon dioxide emissions go unchecked. Furthermore, since there is no current need for building new coal-fired plants in Minnesota, this repeal is completely unnecessary. On a personal level, my grandfather was employed by Northern States Power for over 30 years and worked as an engineer on all 3 units of the Sherco plant in Becker, Minnesota. After retiring, my grandfather recognized the importance of establishing renewable energy infrastructure and ending our reliance on fossil fuels. He told me that while plants like Sherco were necessary for meeting the demand at the time they were built, burning coal was not the future of energy in Minnesota. Hearing this from the man who was construction superintendent to the largest coal-fired plant in Minnesota only demonstrates how urgent and universal the need is for a transformation in the way we produce electricity. This problem has been around for a long time and is not going to go away, so we cannot let the advances we have made go to waste. Please invest in the future of your children, of your community, and of the state of Minnesota by opposing this repeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norgarden.
Norgarden, yes.
Thank you. If you could identify yourself and
thank you,
let
Mr.
us hear
Chair.
Your testimony.
My name is Siri Bugalki, and I am a senior at Stillwater Area High School, and I am also a co-chair of a metro-wide coalition of high school environmental groups called Youth Environmental Activists of Minnesota, sponsored by the Alliance for Sustainability and the Will Steger Foundation. As a student, I am a constant witness of the desire and passion in high schools to encourage sustainability and to protect Minnesota's natural environment. At Green Team, my high school's environmental group, at our first meeting alone, we had 50 kids show up. Yet I'm also aware of the reality of Minnesota's reliance on coal for energy. As every single day coming into school, I see the Allen S. King Coal Plant positioned along the banks of the St. Croix River and the plume of emissions it releases. Scientifically, the CO2 coming from the emissions degrades our ozone layer and our air quality. Economically, coal proves to be just as debilitating for Minnesota, as no coal is produced in Minnesota, and even at the King Coal Plant in my own backyard, the coal originates from Wyoming. $550 million was spent in 2008 alone, sent outside of Minnesota to sponsor jobs outside of our borders to pay for this coal. Now, Minnesota has the resources for pursuing clean energy, whether it is wind, solar, or biofuels. Coal would be simply going a step backwards. President Obama has outlined the importance of a clean energy economy in his State of the Union address. Therefore, Minnesota needs to emerge as a national leader in the clean energy field and continue to protect Minnesota's natural environment and create jobs for Minnesotans.
Thank you. Questions for the testifiers. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the testifiers for coming out today. I think it's really important to remember the name of the bill that we're trying to repeal, part of the Next Generation Energy Act. And I think we have some fantastic representatives of the next generation here testifying. We have a number who've gotten up early for college students. 8:15 is an early start time for a lot of college students. And I really appreciate them coming out to show their support for literally the next generation of energy and the energy that these people, these young people, will put into making our state even better. When you talk about your grandfather building coal plants, he probably would want you to be building the next generation of energy as you look forward into a career. It sounds like that's what he's talked to you about. And so, more of a statement, I just want to express appreciation for people getting involved to show their opposition to pulling the rug out from the kind of clean energy future that this generation, and I'd say my generation, wants to be part of positively making. And I really think it's important to see you all here, and your eloquent testimony is definitely noted by this committee.
Thank you, Representative Knuth. Next, we have Ms. DeCray from MPRIG, and on deck is Alexis Ilian. Ms. DeCray, welcome back to the committee, and if you could give us your testimony, that'd be great. Don't forget to identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kathy DeCray, and I am the board chair of the Minnesota Public Interest and Research Group. I'm here today on behalf of
Mr. DeCray. We have a number of students in the audience that may not know your group. Some of us remember your group from the 70s and our college days and the and the fees we paid to have the group active on our college campuses. Mm-hmm. But for some of the students, they may not know. Can you let us know what MPRIG is?
Yeah, definitely. So a lot of the students in the audience today are actually with our group and whatnot. But MPRIG is a nonpartisan, nonprofit, student-led grassroots advocacy organization that started in 1971. We work on a whole host of public interest issues and are always advocating for that. So that's kind of a general. Anyways, who the student organizations or the students that we represent in the state of Minnesota currently are students from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities, Duluth, Morris, Carleton College, Augsburg College, Hamline University, McAllister College, and St. Catharines University. We want you to know that as a future that is going to inherit the environmental problems created now, we are strongly opposed to lifting this crucial piece of legislation that requires the state to offset any new carbon emissions. When lifted, proponents will look to advance more coal power in the state. a dirty source that impacts public health and contributes to global warming. We need to have the foresight to recognize the serious consequences of our failure to mitigate our carbon footprint. Future generations depend on it. We believe that Americans can not only transition to a clean energy economy, but can prosper as well. Minnesota can take the lead on this. As representatives, we hope you will do what's right. Please support the A2 amendment and renew Minnesota's commitment to a clean energy future. Thank you so much for your time, and I'll be willing to take questions.
Questions for Ms. DeCray. Thank you, Ms. DeCray. Next, Ms. Illion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexis Illion. I am with Restoring Eden. We are a national Christian ministry based here in Minneapolis. And we encourage Christians to love, serve, and protect God's creation and all those who depend on it. And we represent a growing number of young Christians here in the state and nationwide who are deeply concerned about the health of communities and the environment as a result of old and new coal power plants. Restoring Eden works closely with students at Northwestern, Bethel, North Park, and Concordia College, Moorhead. We educate, you know, hundreds of young Christians about the health and environmental consequences of coal power. And through our outreach at Christian Rock Festivals here in Minnesota this summer, we collected over 1,000 signed postcards from young Christians to federal officials asking for strong coal ash regulations. And as young Christians, we really strive to live in a way so where our daily actions and our choices reflect what God has called us to do, to love justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with God. And so we see this call to justice as not only a call to love our neighbor, but also a biblical responsibility to care for God's creation. And as we continue to consume coal to power our daily activities, the repercussions on earth are damaging God's good creation and the livelihood of our neighbors. And so we feel that expecting the coal industry to be a good neighbor, one that does no harm to their fellow neighbors, is not outrageous, but is simply a reasonable cost of doing business. And so we want to see Minnesota move towards an energy system that is guided by our love for God, by justice, and by environmental stewardship. And so we ask you to oppose removing the offset requirement until Minnesota has a plan to meet the pollution reduction goals in the Next Generation Act. Because we must keep Minnesota on course to reduce carbon emissions in order to protect the health of our neighbors and God's creation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Illion. Next, we'll hear from Ken Bradley and then Dale Howey. Mr. Bradley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'm just going to be real brief, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the economics of what we're talking about, and we're really talking about increasing our reliance on imported energy. And while it was already stated today that it's about $500 million a year annually for coal, as a whole it's more than $20 billion is what leaves our state each and every year. And that's $20 billion that's stimulating other states, other nations, often corporations that are pretty unethical, as we've seen, and often nations with pretty questionable ideas as well. So the more that we invest in energy technologies here in our state, like wind and solar and efficiency, the more that we are helping to improve our economy, and we're helping to improve here in Minnesota. And I know there's been a lot said about various renewables already today, but I'm involved with a group called Solar Works for Minnesota. And that coalition has more than 50 businesses in Minnesota, including 3M, which was mentioned earlier today, and companies that are scattered all across the state, from Silicon Energy and Lighthouse up in St. Louis County, to Solar Skies in Douglas County, to Dispatch Energy in Lakeville, Northfield Automotion in Rice County, And the list goes on and on and on. The solar energy industry has actually been one of the fastest growing aspects of the economy during this economic downturn. Venture capitalists invested more in solar energy than any other technology in 2009 during the economic downturn. And in this most recent Minnesota Monthly, the place that says for hot jobs to go, they have a whole section on Minnesota businesses like 10K Solar, Outland Energy Services, Jewel Wind, Innovative Power Systems. 10K Solar, which is located in Bloomington, they're estimating to have 500 to 1,000 new jobs in the next 5 years. These are real jobs. This is real economic development in our state. Now, I love my father dearly, and he's from North Dakota, and my mother's from Minnesota, but on this one, I think I'm going to tend to slide with Minnesotans and Minnesota jobs, and I would ask that everyone in this committee think about doing the same.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. Next, we'll hear from Dale Howey. Mr. Howey.
Hi, my name is Dale Howey. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am a small business owner in Minneapolis, Minnesota, D&E Management. I do property rental management. I drove here today in my converted all-electric Toyota Prius. I am buying my LED bulbs from Titan LED in San Francisco, U.S. company. I tried to buy Made in USA. It's very difficult. Most of the high-efficiency lighting that I use is all made in China. I prefer to support American jobs. I'm glad you mentioned 10K Solar. I'm working with them. We've heard a lot of numbers this morning thrown all over the place. Well, here's some numbers for you. I purchased in 2006 a 50-unit building in South Minneapolis, 1501 Portland Avenue, that was using over $4,000 a month in gas and electric use. It's now under $800 a month. How I did that? High-efficiency boiler, new windows and doors, and a white reflective high-efficiency roof. That money, it paid for all the improvements in 3 years after I did it. So all this is possible. I've zeroed out my office building with 12,000 watts of solar from Solar Flow Energy in Minneapolis, a Minneapolis company, Minnesota-made solar panels. I plan on continuing to go to zero out across the board all my energy use on all my properties, including my house. In my house, I have geothermal, solar hot water, solar PV. I pay next to nothing for utilities. I know the energy people in the room don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that you can produce your own energy. Here's another number. The sun hits us with a year's worth of power every hour of the day. The sun hits us with a year's worth of power of the hour of the day, and it's free. What are we thinking? It's something we can develop in this state. Minnesota jobs. You want jobs? The construction industry wants jobs. More construction. Develop a house in Hudson, Wisconsin. Zero energy. It produces 125% of the energy it uses, and he says that it only costs 10% more than current construction costs. 10% more for no energy, surplus energy on a home. So we want jobs. We want to save energy. You could start right now by changing the building code and demanding more alternative energy and high-efficiency home performance.
Thank you, Mr. Howey. Next, we'll hear Reed, and I can't pronounce your last name. I apologize if you could let us know when you get here. And after Reed is Carrie Ann Johnson. And those are the only, and Bill Glahn are the only citizens I have left to testify. Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Hi, this is Reed Aronow. I'm here as a Minnesota youth delegate to the United Nations Framework Conferences on Climate Change, and I'm here to stress my opposition to House File Number 72. First of all, I just want to be upfront. I'm here as a fiscally and environmentally conservative, and I just want to say we've got to think about this.
I haven't had to do this yet this year, but I'm going to actually ask you to back away from the mic a little bit. Thank you. A little bit closer and you'll be fine. All right. You're good.
Is this good?
Yeah.
Not used to doing this. Sorry.
Well, you'll be able to roll through it really quick now that you're relaxed. Go ahead.
I'm much more relaxed now. So I just want to stress everyone here to think about what is really the most comprehensive and long-term and enduringly cost-effective strategy. And to look at the whole picture. Right now, we're hearing that coal is plentiful, but what else is plentiful? Also plentiful are the negative consequences of its youth, of its use. What's plentiful are its health aspects. What's plentiful is, as a person with asthma, the asthma attacks that I feel. What's plentiful is the climate-induced things that we are seeing. What's plentiful is the lost business opportunities if we take this choice. As through my experience at the United Nations as a youth delegate, we left COP 16 in Cancun, Mexico, with some things that were achieved, but not as many as we had hoped. And one thing that I learned from a conversation with President Felipe Calderon of Mexico, he told me that what really needs to happen, where the real solutions to clean energy issues need to start, is at the state level, at the regional level. So this is on you to solve this, on you to create business opportunities that are also good for the environment. So when we're talking about what is plentiful, we heard from Dale Howie that sunshine is also a very plentiful resource. We get a year's worth of power every day, he said. Perhaps that's something that we could focus on more. And there are all across Minnesota, what's plentiful is the entrepreneurial spirit of small businesses that are starting business around solar, around wind. Minnesota is seen in the country and at the United Nations even as a leader in these issues. And so this is something that can attract a lot of business to the state. Recently, I just want to tell a really short story. I went out to Montevideo.
Mr. Arnau, you're going to have to be really quick because I want to be sure that I allow these other people to testify.
Of course. In Montevideo, I spoke with a group of 20 Republicans. Someone introduced me and said, this guy believes in climate change. They all said, whatever, but then I learned that they're all doing things around clean energy. There's a guy who started a grocery store, which is also energy efficient, and I'd urge you to look at Montevideo as an example of how this issue is not only like Democrat or Republican, this is something we can all gain from. So thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, representatives, and thank you for citizens coming out this early in the morning. My name is Carrie Ann Johnson. I'm a citizen in East Phillips, one of the most toxic-laden areas in Minnesota, I believe, at least within this metro area. I'm speaking as somebody, as a mother. I actually, incidentally, did canvass with MPRG about 5 years ago and learned a few lessons talking to people there about what's going on. Basically, as a mother and as somebody who grew up in Minnesota swimming in the Great Lakes here, I am very, very saddened that I can no longer consciously step into a lake anymore, and I cannot bring my child swimming because of the mercury that is laden in our Great Lakes, which is supposed to be one of our great resources. I'm sad that I can never take my son fishing and introduce him to enjoying some walleye because I am so concerned with the overburden of mercury on his system. That's something that doesn't have to be there. We should not be focusing on adding to our problems. We talk about creating new jobs. We have plenty of work in front of us, plenty of work cleaning things up. I've spent the last 3 years as a citizen restoring my yard to a native prairie. I've done this because I want to grow food. However, I cannot just straight away grow food in my yard without consuming all of the toxins that I'm subject to since I live on a major arterial. So I'm spending my time restoring, growing plants that are going to absorb the pollutants and get rid of it, planting mushrooms to take up the heavy metals and the sunflowers that I need to get rid of that, so that I can grow food and so that I can feed my community. By acting locally, I am going to reduce the emissions that I need to create in the first place to receive that food. I really would like for everyone here to act as the leaders that our state is and to not basically insult the work that I am doing and to insult the work that everyone who is doing so much to change our situation, to reduce the toxins in our life. I can't tell you how many times I found myself telling my three-year-old the word toxin on a regular basis when he grabs something, when he picks something up, when he can't eat something. I keep having to say the word toxin. Sorry, honey, this is toxic. Sorry, honey, there's too many chemicals in this. We need to get ourselves back off of this. But I don't want to dwell in the negative. I want you, and I don't want you to dwell in the negative too. I want you to remember and to realize that this right now, this bill is a distraction, and it's a distraction from the work we need to be doing, and that by every one of you in this room actually realizing in your mind what you want to have happen and to consciously subject yourself to the will that you want to create, that is what we will have. You need to focus on that. We all need to focus on that. I'm focusing on creating my food locally and on conserving. I took my shower this morning by candlelight. I didn't need more than that, and I blew it out when I was done. I think every one of us can subject ourselves to a higher standard on conservation, and I ask that our state does the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Glock. Thank you for testifying.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Glon. I'm from Edina, Minnesota, and I'm unemployed. I did want to commend to the committee very quickly a cover story from the Atlantic Monthly, James Fallows, Why the Future of Clean Energy is Dirty Coal. It's the only way to stop global warming. I think it's available online. Very quickly, because I know we're already past time, I rise in support, or I speak in support of the passage of House File 72, and I urge members to vote in favor of Mr. Beard's bill. And for a number of reasons, very quickly, the premise upon which the bill was passed, or the section of the law that we would have a functioning cap-and-trade system so a Great River Energy could buy allowances, or that we would have a functioning allowance market, it just simply has not come to pass, and there's no prospect in the near term that it will. My hope in holding the office of Director of Energy Security that perhaps Minnesota could be a showpiece for these sort of projects like the Spiritwood project that we heard from Great River Energy, combined heat and power, very efficient, state-of-the-art pollution abatement. China is scheduled in the next 5 years or so to build another 330 gigawatts of coal power. And despite all what you've heard about their investment in wind power and nuclear power, their share of coal power as a total is barely going to drop, something from 70 to 67%. They are building more efficient next-generation coal plants, and it was my hope that perhaps Minnesota could one day be a host to show the rest of the world how to do it right. Very quickly, to respond to some of these arguments that we know utilities are proposing this, so therefore we're not needed. I looked at the resource plans when this thing took effect in 2009. We had something like 1,200 megawatts of baseload requirements for which there was no project identified, and you know, we have outlawed nuclear power, we've outlawed de facto new coal power, and the utilities dutifully report that they have no plans to build these facilities, and somehow through circular reasoning we take that as evidence that they're not needed. But I disagree. And so I finally very quickly want to go through the A2 amendment. I don't know if it's going to be offered today, but Daniel Hannan, he's a British lawmaker, and he has spoken against this trend of what he calls declaratory lawmaking, or also aspirational lawmaking, or postmodern lawmaking, where we're writing laws based on not how the world is, but how we would like to see the world. And I see the A2 amendment as falling into that category. And his concern that he's expressed as a lawmaker is that when you do that, when you pass laws based not on how the universe works, but on how you would like to see it, you end up with more unintended consequences. And so what we've heard today are concerns about mercury, our concerns about particulate matter. 216H only regulates carbon dioxide. It does not regulate these other pollutants. If you want to attack mercury, regulate mercury. If you want to attack particulate matter, regulate that directly. If you want to help folks with asthma, look at indoor air quality. Attack the problem directly and stay away from this postmodern declaratory lawmaking. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that could be made.
Well, Mr. Glon, I appreciate that, and we do have a couple of people that would like to ask you questions. You mentioned, I believe, I couldn't hear, as many folks know, I don't hear real well. I had to ask the committee legislative assistant. I think the last thing you said was the word unemployed. Would that mean you're available next Tuesday morning to come back? The committee members would like to ask some questions.
Mr. Chair, off the top of my head, I believe I will be.
Okay, and if they're not, we'll get the questions to you online, and you can answer them, and we'll forward them to all the committee. Members, we're going to come back after consulting with both sides of the aisle. This needs more discussion. We got all the public testimony. Other than Mr. Glon, we'll come back, and we'll take some questions. I think Representative Falk had a question. Representative Qualm both had a question for Mr. Glahn. So if you're available, we'll bring you back quick in the morning. And then Representative Beard will continue your bill. Members, we have the minutes before us. If we could approve the minutes, and then the next thing, we're gonna lay the bill over to bring it back on Tuesday. Representative Drazkowski, have you seen the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair. I move for their approval.
Thank you. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion carries. We're adjourned.